making angels in the snow, cheeks rosy and eyes at the sky. But Hal's face was pale and thoroughly unchildlike, his gaze somehow extending only half a meter in front of him. He looked nothing like the punter. The service motion's middle might be a man at a precipice, falling forward, giving in sweetly to his own weight, and the serve's terminus and impact a hammering man, the driven nail just within range at the top of his tiptoed reach. But all these were only parts, and made the motion seem segmented, when the smaller, crew-cutted, jowly boy was the one with the stuttered motion, the man of parts. Steepley had played tennis only a couple times with his wife, and had felt ungainly and simian out there. The punter's discourses on the game had been lengthy but not much use. It was unlikely that any one game figured much in the entertainment. Hal and Candenza's first serve was a tactically aggressive shot, but not immediately identifiable as such. Stice wanted to serve so hard he could set himself up to put the ball away on the next shot, up at net. Hal's serve seemed to set in motion a much more involved mechanism, one that took several exchanges to reveal itself as aggressive. His first serve hadn't Stice's pace, but it had depth, plus a topspin Hal achieved with an arched back and faint brushing action over the back of the ball that made the serve curve visibly in the air, egg-shaped with spin, to land deep in the box and hop up high so that Stice couldn't do more than send back a deep backhand chip from shoulder height, and then couldn't come in behind a return that had been robbed of all pace. Stice moved to the baseline center as the chip floated back to Hal. Hal's pivot moved him right so he could take it on the forehand.
268.
Another looper dripping with top, right back in the same corner he'd served to, so that Stice had to stop and sprint back the same way he'd come. Stice drove this backhand hard down the line to Hal's forehand, a blazing thing that made the audience inhale. But as the Samizdat director's other son glided a few strides left, Steepley could see that he now had a whole open court to hit cross-court into, Stice having hit so hard he'd backpedaled a bit off the shot and was now scrambling to get back out of the deuce corner. And Hal hit the flat textbook drive cross-court into green-lined space. Hard, but not flamboyantly so, and the diagonal of the ball kept it traveling out wide after it hit Stice's ad sideline, carrying it away from the boy in black's outstretched racket. And for a second it looked as if Stice, at a dead run, might get his strings on the ball, but the ball stayed tantalizingly just out of reach, still traveling at a severe cross-court diagonal, and it passed Stice's racket half a meter past its rim, and Stice's momentum carried him almost halfway into the next court. Stice slowed to a jog to go retrieve the ball. Hal stood slightly hip-shot on the ad side, waiting for Stice to get back and let him serve again. DeLint, whose peripheral vision's acuity and disguise was an ETA legend, observed the big journalist chew her nib for a second and then put down nothing more than the Greg ideogram for pretty, shaking her fuchsia cap.
"Wasn't that pretty?" he said blandly.
Steepley rooted for a hanky.
"Not exactly."
"Hal's in essence a torturer, if you want his essence as a player, instead of a straight-out killer like Stice or the Canadian Wayne," DeLint said. "This is why you don't stay back or play safe against Hal. This way of the ball seeming just in reach to keep you trying, running, he yanks you around. Always two or three shots ahead. He won that point on the deep forehand after the serve. The second he had Stice wrong-footed, you could see the angle open up. Though the serve set the whole thing up in advance and without the risk of much pace on it. The kid doesn't need pace, we've helped him find."
"When might I get a chance to talk to him?"
"In Condensa took a lot of bringing along. He didn't used to quite have the complete game to be able to do this. Slice the court up into sections and chinks, then all of a sudden you see light through one of the chinks and you see he's been setting up the angle since the start of the point. It makes you think of chess."
The journalist blew her red nose.
"Chess on the run.
Nice term."
Hal went into his service motion to the ad court.
"Do the students play chess here?"
A mirthless chuckle.
"No time."
"Do you play chess?"
Stice hit a backhand winner off Hal's second serve. Mild applause.
I don't have time to play anything, DeLynn said, filling in a square.
You could tell by the sound that the other boy's racket was strung tighter than Hal's.
When do I get to sit down with Hal directly?
I don't know. I don't think you do.
The journalist's rapid head movement reconfigured the flesh of her neck.
Pardon me?
It's not my decision. My guess is you don't. Dr. Tavis didn't already tell you?
I really couldn't tell what he was telling me.
We've never had a kid here interviewed. The founder let you guys on the grounds. Versus Tavis, this is an exception. You're even getting in.
I'm here for background only. For your alumnus, the punter.
DeLynn was making his lips look like he was whistling, even though no whistling sound was emerging.
We've never let somebody do any kind of interview on a kid here while he's still in training and inculcation.
Does the student have some sort of say in who he talks to and why? What if the boy wants to chat with me about his brother's transition from tennis to football?
DeLynn kept his concentration on the match and the chart in a way that was supposed to let you know you had very little of his attention.
I talked to Tavis about it.
I was in there for over 2 hours.
You pick up how to do questions with him after a while. Tavis, you have to back into a yes-no corner where you can finally say, I need a yes or a no. It takes about 20 minutes if you're sharp. This is your whole business, getting answers out of people. The answer's not for me to officially say, but I'm guessing a no. The Boston press guys come around after a big event. They get match results and physical stats and hometowns and nothing more.
Moment is a national magazine for and about exceptional people, not some sports writer with a cigar and a deadline.
It's a command decision, babe. I'm not in command. I know they teach us to teach that this place is about seeing instead of being seen.
I'm here only for the human interest perspective of a talented boy on his talented brother's bowl transition to a major sport where he's shown himself to be even more talented. One exceptional brother on another. Hal is not the profile's focus.
Get Tavis in the right corner and he'll tell you about seeing and being seen. These kids, the best of them, are here to learn to see.
Schitt's thing is self-transcendence through pain. These kids, gesturing at Stice, running madly up for a drop volley that stopped rolling well inside the service line. Mild applause.
They're here to get lost in something bigger than them. To have it stay the way it was when they started. The game is something bigger at first. Then they show talent, start winning, become big fish in their ponds out there in their hometowns, stop being able to get lost inside the game and see. Fucks with the junior's head, talent. They pay top dollar to come here and go back to being little fish, and to get savaged and feel small and see and develop. To forget themselves as objects of attention for a few years and see what they can do when the eyes are off them. They didn't come here to get read about as some soft news item or background, babe.
DeLynn read Steepley's expression as some kind of tick. The tiniest tuft of nostril hair protruded from one of her nostrils, which DeLynn found repellent. She said,
"Were you ever written about as a player?"
DeLynn smiled coolly at his charts.
Never had the sort of ranking or promise this issue to even come up for me.
But some of these do. Hal's brother did.
DeLynn felt along his lips outline with his pencil. Sniffed.
Orin was okay. Orin was essentially a one-trick pony as a player. And between you and me and the fence, he was kind of a head case. His game left here on the downswing. Now his little brother's got a future in tennis if he wants. And Ortho. Wayne, for sure. Couple other girls. Kent, Karen, and Sharon here, indicating the vault apparition below them. The really gifted ones, the ones that make it out of here still on the upswing, if they get to the show.
Meaning professional, you mean?
In the show, they'll get all they want of being made into statues to be looked at and poked at and discussed, and then some. For now, they're here to get to be the ones who look and see and forget getting looked at. For now.
But even you call it the show. They'll be entertainers.
You bet your ass they will be.
So audiences will be the whole point. Why not also prepare them for the stresses of entertaining an audience, get them used to being seen?
The two boys were at the near net post, Stice blowing his nose into a towel. Dillent made kind of a show of putting his clipboard down. Assume wrongly for a second that I can speak for the Enfield Academy. I say you do not get it. The point here for the best kids is to inculcate their sense that it's never about being seen. It's never. If they can get that inculcated, the show won't fuck them up, Stitt thinks. If they can forget everything but the game when all of you out there outside the fence see only them and want only them, and the game's incidental to you. For you, it's about entertainment and personality. It's about the statue. But if they can get inculcated right, they'll never be slaves to the statue. They'll never blow their brains out after winning an event when they win, or dive out a third-story window when they start to stop getting poked at or profiled, when their blossom starts to fade. Whether or not you mean to, babe, you chew them up. It's what you do.
We chew statues?
Whether you mean to or no, you, moments, world tennis, self, interlace, the audiences, the crowds in Italy fucking literally. It's the nature of the game. It's the machine they're all dying to throw themselves into. They don't know the machine, but we do. Gerhardt's teaching him to see the ball out of a place inside that can't be chewed. It takes time and total focus. The man's a fucking genius. Profile Stitt if you want to profile somebody.
And I'm not going to be allowed to even ask the students what it looks like, this inside, chew-proof place. It's a secret place.
Hal mishit a second serve, and it flew off his frame and way down to where the girls were sending each other squeaks and lobs. And Stice had now broken him to go up 6-5, and the murmurs in the bleachers were like a courtroom at an unpleasant revelation. Dillent rounded his lips and made a kind of bovine sound in Ortho Stice's direction. Hal chipped his balls out along the baseline and made some small adjustments in his cross-hatched strings as he walked around for the side change. A couple of the nastier kids applauded Hal's mishit a little. Get sardonic with me all you want. I already said it's not my command decision. I wouldn't get sardonic with Tavis, though.
But if it were your command?
Lady, if it was me, you'd be pressing your nose between the bars of the gate down there is as far in as you'd get. You're coming into a little slice of space and or time that's been carved out to protect talented kids from exactly the kind of activities you guys come in here to do. Why Orin, anyway? The kid appears 4 times a game, never gets hit, doesn't even wear pads. A one-trick pony. Why not John Wayne? A more dramatic story. Geopolitics, privation, exile, drama. A better player than Hal, even. A more complete game. Aimed like a fucking missile at the show. Maybe the top 5 if he doesn't fuck up or burn down. Wayne's your ideal food group. Which is why we'll keep you off him as long as he's here. The soft profiler looked around at the scalps and knees in the stands, the bags of gear, and a couple incongruous cans of furniture polish.
Carved out of what, though? This place?
From the desk of Helen Steepley, contributing editor, Moment Magazine, 13473, Blasted Expanse Boulevard, Tucson, Arizona, 85704878-7/2. Mr. Marlon K. Bain, Saprogenic Greetings, Inc., BPL, Waltham, Building 1214, Totten Pond Road, Waltham, Massachusetts, 02154-9872/4, November, YDAU. Dear Mr. Bain, in Phoenix on other business, it has been my good fortune to meet your adolescent friend, Mr. Orin J. Incandenza, and to have become intrigued with the possibilities of a profile of the Incandenza family and its accomplishments in not only sports but wide-ranging topics such as independent film circa metropolitan Boston, past and present. I am writing to ask for your cooperation in contacting you with questions which you could answer in writing, as I am informed by Mr. Orin Incandenza you dislike to meet people outside your home and office. I am hoping to hear from you in response to this request at your earliest convenience, etc., etc., etc. Saprogenic Greetings, a proud member of the Acme family of gags and notions. When you care enough to let a professional say it for you. Prepackaged emotions, jokes, and surprises and wacky disguises. Ms. Helen Steeply and so on. November, YDAU. Dear Ms. Steeply, fire away. VD. M.K. Bain, Saprogenic Greetings, /Acme. From the desk of Helen Steeply, contributing editor, Moment Magazine, 13473 Blasted Expanse Boulevard, Tucson, Arizona, 85704878/2. Mr. M.K. Bain, Saprogenic Greetings, Inc., BPL, Waltham, Building 1214, Totten Pond Road, Waltham, Massachusetts, 02154987/4, November, YDAU. Dear Mr. Bain, question.
269.
Carved out of sedimentary shale and ferrous granite and generic morphic crud, at more or less the same time the hilltop's bulge was shaved off and rolled and impacted level for tennis, are ETA's abundant tunnels. There are access tunnels and hallway tunnels with rooms and labs and pump rooms lung nexus off both sides, utility tunnels and storage tunnels, and little blunt off tunnels connecting tunnels to other tunnels. Maybe about 16 different tunnels in all, in a shape that's more generally ovoid than anything else. The 11th of November, 1625 hours. Lamont Chu, Josh Gopnik, Audern Talat Kelpsa, Philip Traub, Tim Sleepy T.P. Peterson, Carl Whale, Kieran McKenna, the bulk of the ambulatory sub-14 male Escotonites, plus 10-year-old Kent Blott, are 26 meters directly below the Howl/Darkness matches show court with Glad handle-tie trash bags
270
and BP low-diffusion compact mercuric flashlights. Plus, Chew has a clipboard with a pen attached to its clamp with twine. The sounds of competitive sneaker movement and spectatorial bleacher squeaks on the surface, traveling down through meters of compacted crud and polymerized cement tunnel ceiling with parquet layer, sound rather like the stealthy dry scuttle of rodents, vermin. And this heightens the excitement that's part of why they're really down here. One part of the reason they're down here is that small U.S. boys seem to have this fetish for getting down in the enclosed fundaments underneath things. Tunnels, caves, ventilator shafts, the horrific areas beneath wooden porches. Rather, the way older U.S. boys like great perspectival heights and spectacular views encompassing huge swaths of territory. This latter fetish accounting for why ETA's hilltop site is one of its trump cards in the recruiting war with Port Washington and other eastern seaboard academies. Another part is a semi-punitive shit detail in which certain players, judged to have been involved in the recent Escaton non-strategic combat debacle, but who are uninjured,
271,
and not in the much severer hot water that the big buddies on the scene are in, have been punitively remanded below ground in PM shifts on what's supposed to constitute an unpleasant chore. To scout out the tunneled route, the Testar All-Weather Inflatable Structures Corporation's professional guys will have to take as they haul out from the lung storage room the fiberglass struts and crosspieces and dendrourethane folds that compose the lung for erection of the lung when the ETA administration finally decides that the late fall weather has gone beyond character building and become an impediment to development and morale. This will be soon. Because the pro-rectors live in rooms off the larger tunnels and FDV Hardy's physical plant and maintenance guys have their offices and supplies down here, and because Dr. James Incandenza's old optics and editing facilities are down here off one of the main tunnels and get used for Leith Ogilvy classes in entertainment production and for optical science tutorials, etc., and because a couple of the secondary and off tunnels are used for temporary storage by departing seniors who can't tote 8 or more years' worth of accumulated stuff in one postgraduate load, especially if they jet off to some novitiate pro satellite circuit for the summer, because that means air travel, 2 bags plus gear max, some of the tunnels become badly littered in the warm season with trash-type material. And sometimes there's bulky possession-type overflow from the little curved storage tunnels off the prorector's hallway. Smaller kids are perfect for recons into low, narrow tunnels, partly blocked with dross. And even though it's no secret around ETA that the smaller boys spend a fair amount of time down in the tunnels anyway, a retributive aspect is lent to this recon detail by making the kids take down handle-tie trash bags to clear away littered exam papers and lab handouts, calculator batteries and banana peels, and Kodiak smokeless tobacco tins, and spirals of synthetic gut racket string, and maintenance guy's hideous cigar butts. Sleepy TP finds two bright Trojan wrappers just off the prorector's hallway tunnel, and then a couple meters farther along the floor, the vermiform gleam of an actual condom, and there's some high-register debate about whether it's a used condom or not. And poor old Kent Blott is finally put in charge of picking it up and putting it in a trash bag, just in case it's a used condom. And empty boxes of complimentary corporate gear, and full boxes of faggy or poorly absorbent gear nobody wants, and Habitant can wrappers, and senior trunks, and dorm-sized fridgelets, etc. And also to move whatever boxes they can heft, clear them out of the Testar guy's access route into the lung storage and pump rooms. And Lamont Shue was supposed to note the location of any boxes or objects too bulky for them to move out of the way, and beefy custodial guys will be dispatched to handle them as they see fit. This is why a fair number of the smaller ETA males don't see Stice take a set off Hal and Candenza and nearly beat him, is that they were remanded down here by Neil Hartigan right after post-conditioning showers. As noted already, they don't much mind it, being down here, now in one of the child-size, diametered off-tunnels between the prorector's hallway and the lung storage room. The Eschatonites are down here quite a lot anyway. In fact, the sub-14 ETAs historically have a kind of tunnel club. Like many small boys' clubs, the tunnel club's unifying raison d'etre is kind of vague. Tunnel club activities mostly involve congregating informally in the better-lit main tunnels and hanging out and catching each other in lies about their lives and careers before ETA, and recapitulating the most recent eschaton, usually only about 5 a term. And the club's only formal activity is sitting around with a yellowed copy of Robert's Rules, endlessly refining and amending the rules for who can and can't join the tunnel club. A true boy-type club, the tunnel club's least vague raison d'etre has to do with exclusion. The vital no-girls exclusion is the only ironclad part of the tunnel club's charter.
272.
With the exception of Kent Blott, every boy down here on this detail is an eschatonite and a member of the tunnel club. Kent Blott, ineligible for eschaton because he's a humanities-type kid and hasn't even taken quadrivial algebra yet, and excluded from the club under every incarnation of the eligibility requirements thus far, is down here solely because he was heard to maintain at lunch that he was in the north part of the main tunnel between the ComEd locker rooms and the subterranean laundry room this AM, shortcutting back to his room in West House after drills and a sauna, and claimed to have espied, scuttling out of his mercuric light toward one of the secondary tunnels to subdorms C and D and the East Courts and this same general tunnel area they're now in, to have sighted what was either a rat or, he said, what looked even more like a concavitated feral hamster. So, the eschatonites are also enthusiastic to be down here for potential rodent recon, checking out Blott's claim, and they've brought what's either a very nervous or very excited Blott down with them, so they can trace the possible routes Blott said he saw the rodent maybe take, filling their glad handle ties and noting heavy items along the way, and also so they can immediately encircle and discipline Kent Blott if it turns out he was yanking people's chains. Plus, they make Blott be the one to take full trash bags and tie their plastic handles together and drag them back to where the expedition started, the entrance to the large, smooth main tunnel by the boys' sauna, since none of them enjoys dragging full trash bags solo through dark tunnels with the rodential squeaking of match play and spectation far above. Chu holds a penlight in his teeth and writes heavy stuff down. They filled several bags and got in the lighter shit, stacked off back enough to create a narrow route almost all the way to the pump room, around which room hangs a strange, sweet, stale, burny smell that none of them can place. The applause, as Howling Condensa barely takes the first set, above, sounds down here like faraway rain. The off-tunnel's dark as a pocket, but warm and dry, and there's surprisingly little dust. Ducts and coaxials running along the low ceiling make Whale and Talat Kelpsa have to crouch as they walk point, clearing boxes and trying unsuccessfully to move fridgelets back out of the way. There are several pockets of small but heavy, dorm-size Maytag fridgelets, the kind of thing no graduate takes with him, paneled in dark wood-grain plastic, some of them old models with three-prong plugs instead of chargers. Some of the empty fridgelets have been indifferently scrubbed out and have their doors partway open and smell stale. Most of Chu's inventory for beefy adult removal are either fridgelets or locked trunks, full of what sound like magazines and 8-year-old accumulations of pennies. The muffled rodential squeak of sneakers far overhead excites the Tunnel Club boys and puts them on edge. Philip Traub keeps making little squeaky noises and secretly tickling the back of people's necks, causing enormous excitement and much stopping and starting and tightly enclosed whirling around, until Kieran McKenna captures Traub tickling Josh Gopnik in the bright beam of his PB light, and Gopnik punches Traub in the radial nerve, and Traub clutches his arm and weeps and says he's quitting and going topside. Traub's the youngest kid here except for Blot, and is a probationary second-string launcher in most eschatons. And they have the stop and let you note and mark two discarded fridgelets while Peterson and Gopnik try to distract and amuse Traub into staying and not retreating back up to Nwangi and making a high-pitched stink. Discarded fridgelets, empty boxes, immovable and complexly addressed labeled trunks, used athletic tape and ace bandages, the occasional empty Visine bottle, which Blot stashes in his sweatshirt pouch for Mike Pemulis's next contest, Optics 1 and 2 lab reports, broken ball machines and stray tennis balls too dead even for the repressurization machine, broken or discarded TP cartridges of stroke analysis filmings or worn-out entertainments, an anomalous set of parfait glasses, fruit peels, and AminoPal energy bar wrappers that the club itself had left down here after meetings, discarded curls of grip and tensile string, several incongruous barrettes, several old broadcast televisions some older kids used to like to keep around to watch the static, and, along the seam of wall and floor, brittle, limb-shaped husks of exfoliated pledge, expanses of arm and leg already half-decayed into fragrant dust. This comprising the bulk of the crud down here, and the kids don't much mind scanning and inventorying and bagging it, because their minds are diverted by something else, very exciting. A kind of possible raison d'etre for the club itself. Unless Blot had been tweaking their units, in which case, look out, Blot, is the consensus. Gopnik to a sniffling Traub, while Peterson shines his flashlight on the clipboard for Chu. Mary had a little lamb, its fleece electrostatic, and everywhere that Mary went, the lights became erratic. Carl Whale pretends to be immensely fat and moves along the wall with a blimpish, splay-legged waddle. Peterson to Traub, while Gopnik holds the light. 18-year-old top-ranked John Wayne had sex with Herr Stitt on a train. They had sex again, and again and again, and again and again and again. Which the slightly older kids find more entertaining than Traub does. Kent Blot asks why a wispy-dicked blubberer like Phil gets to be in the Tunnel Club while his own applications get turned down. And Talat Kelpsa cuts him short by doing something to him in the dark that makes Blot shriek. It's utterly dark, except for the dime-sized discs of their low-diffusion BPs, because they've left the tunnel strings of bare overhead bulbs off, because Gopnik, who's originally from Brooklyn and knows from rodents, says only a complete booger-eating moron would do rat reconnaissance in the light, and it seems reasonable to assume that feral hamsters also have a basically ratty attitude toward light. Chu has Blot see whether he can lift a bulky, old, doorless microwave oven that's lying on its side up next to one wall, and Blot tries, and barely lifts it, and pules. And Chu marks the oven down for the adults to lift, and tells Blot to drop it, which invitation Blot takes literally, and the crash and tinkle infuriate Gopnik and McKenna, who say that scanning for rodents with Blot is like fly fishing with an epileptic, which cheers Traub up quite a bit. Feral hamsters, bogey-wise right up there with mile-high toddlers, skull-deprived wraiths, carnivorous flora, and marsh gas that melts your face off and leaves you with exposed gray and red facial musculature for the rest of your ghoulish pariah life in terms of late-night hair-raising concavity narratives, are rarely sighted south of the Lucite Walls and ATH-SCME'd checkpoints that delimit the Great Concavity, and only once in a blue moon anywhere south of, like, the new border burg of Methuen, Massachusetts, whose Chamber of Commerce calls it the city that interdependence rebuilt. And anyway, Pache Blot are hardly ever seen solo, being the sort of rapacious, locust-like, mass-movement creature that Canadian agronomists call piranha of the plains. An infestation of feral hamsters in the waste-rich terrain of Metro Boston, to say nothing of the clutter-tunneled ETA grounds, would be an almost grand-scale public health disaster, would cause simply no end of adult running in circles and knuckle-biting, and would consume mega-calories of displaced pre-adolescent stress for the ETA players. Every ear-cocked, eye-peeled, bag-toting kid in the off-tunnel this afternoon is hoping hamster in a big way, except for Kent Blot, who's hoping simply and fervently for some sort of rodential sighting or scat sample that'll keep him from being disciplinarily hung upside down in a lavatory stall to shriek until a staff member finds him. He reminds the tunnel clubbers that it's not like he'd claimed he espied the thing actually heading in this direction. He'd only seen the thing scuttling in a way that seemed to suggest a tendency or, like, probability of heading in this direction. One whole box on its side with its frayed strapping tape split has spilled part of a load of old TP cartridges, old and mostly unlabeled, out onto the tunnel floor in a fannish pattern, and Gopnik and Peterson complain that the cartridge case's sharp edges put holes in their glad bags, and Blot is dispatched with 3 bags of cartridges and fruit rinds, each only about half full, back to the lit vestibule outside the ComAd tunnel start, where a serious pile of bags is starting to pile fragrantly up. Plus, a confirmed feral hamster sighting, Chu and Gopnik and STP Peterson have agreed, could well distract the headmaster's office from post-eschaton reprisals against big buddies Pemulus, Incandenza, and Axford, whom the club's eschatonite faction doesn't want to see reprised against, particularly. Though the consensus is nobody would much mind seeing the malefic Anne Kitten plan hung out to dry in a serious way. Plus, hamster incursions could be posited to account for the occult appearance of large and incongruous ETA objects in inappropriate places, which started in August with the thousands of practice balls found scattered all over the blue lobby carpeting and the carefully arranged pyramid of AminoPal energy bars found on court number 6 at Dawn Drills in mid-September, and has gained momentum in a way no one cares for one bit, feral hamsters being notorious draggers and rearrangers of stuff they can't eat but feel compelled to fuck with anyway, somehow. And so ease the communal near-hysteria the objects have caused among Aboriginal blue-collar staff and sub-16 ETA alike. Which would make the Tunnel Club guys something like heroes, foreseeably. They move along the tunnel, their mercuric lights crossing and separating and forming jagged angles, colored faintly pink. But even a confirmed rat would be a coup. Dean of Academic Affairs, Mrs. Ink, has a violent phobic thing about vermin and waste and insects and overall facility hygiene, and Orkin men with beer bellies and playing cards with naked girls and high-heeled shoes on the backs, McKenna's claim, spray the bejesus out of the ETA grounds twice a semester. None of the younger ETA boys, who have the same post-latency fetish for vermin they have about subterranean access and exclusive clubs, none of them has ever once gotten to see or trap a rat or roach or even so much as a lousy silverfish anyplace around here. So the unspoken consensus is that a hamster'd be optimal, but they'd settle for a rat. Just one lousy rat could give the whole club a legit raison, an explicable reason for congregating underground. All of them are a bit uneasy about liking to congregate underground, for no good or clear reason. Sleeps, you think you could lift that and carry it? Chew, man, I wouldn't even get up next to whatever that is, much less touch it. Blot's footfalls and tuneless whistling can be heard from far away, returning, and the distant squeak of overhead sneakers. Gopnik stops and his light pans playing on faces. Okay, somebody farted. What's this up next to it, Sleeps? Chew, backing up to widen his light beam on something broad and squat and dark. Can I get some lights over here on this, you guys? Because did somebody go ahead and cut one in this little unventilated space? Chew, it's a room fridge, that's all. But it's bigger than the room fridges. But it's not as big as a real fridge. It's in between. I do smell something, though, Gop, I admit. There is a smell. If somebody farted, speak up. Otherwise, it's a smell. Don't try to describe it. Sleeps. That's no human fart I've ever smelled. It's too powerful for a fart. Maybe Teddy Shocked was having an attack and staggered down here just to cut one. Peterson trains his light on the mid-sized brown fridge. You don't possibly think. Chew says, no way. No way. What? Blot says. Don't even think it, Chew says. I don't even think any kind of mammal could fart that bad, Chew. Peterson's looking at Chew, both of their faces pale in the mercuric light. No way somebody'd graduate and leave and put their fridge down here without taking the food out. Blot goes, is that the smell? Was this Pearson's fridge last year? Sleepy TP turns around. Who smells a decay element? Lights on the tunnel ceiling from upraised hands. Quorum on decay type odor. Should we check? Chew says. Blot's hamster might be in there. Gnawing on something unspeakable, maybe. You mean open it? Pearson had a bigger than usual fridge. Open it? Chew scratches behind his ear. Me and Gopple light it up. Peterson opens it. Why me? You're closest, Sleeps. Hold your breath. Jesus. Well, back off up here so I can jump way back if anything, flies out. Nobody could be so low. Who would go off and leave a full fridge? Happy to back way, way off, says Carl Whale, his light receding. Not even Pearson could be that low, leaving food in an unplugged fridge. This could explain rodent attraction and then some. Now look out. Ready? Ow, get off! Put the light over... Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Such a smell I'm smelling! There's mayonnaise! Oh, he left mayonnaise in there! Why the bulge in the top of the lid? The ballooning carton of orange juice! Nothing could live in that, rodent or otherwise. So why is that sandwich meat moving? Maggots? Maggots! Shut it! Sleeps! Oh, kick it shut! This right here is exactly as close as I'm ever getting to that fridge ever again, Chew.
The smell's expanding.
I can smell it from here,
wails tiny distant voice.
I'm not enjoying this at all. This is death. Woe to those that gazeth on death. The Bible.
What are maggots?
Should we just run really fast the other way?
Second that, this is probably what the rat or hamster smelled, Blot ventures. Run! High receding voices, bobbing lights. Whale's light way out front. After Stison and Candenza split the first two sets and Hal dashed into the locker room at the break to put Collyrium brand eyewash in eyes that were bothering him, and Delint made warped crashing sounds on the tiers as he walked down the bleachers and over to have a word with Stice, who was squatting against the net post, holding his left arm up like a scrubbed surgeon and applying a towel to the arm. Delint's place up next to Helen Steepley was taken by female prorector Terry Poutrincourt. Freshly showered, long-faced, a non-U.S. citizen, a tall Quebecer, former satellite pro in rimless specs, and a violetish ski cap just enough of a shade away from the journalist's hat to make the people behind them pretend to shield their eyes from the clash. The putative newshound introduced herself and asked Poutrincourt who the heavy-browed kid was at the end of the top bleacher behind them, hunched over and gesturing and speaking into his empty fist.
James Trocha Philadelphia is better to leave alone to play the broadcaster to himself.
He is strange and unhappy, Poutrincourt said, her face long and cavern-cheeked and not terribly happy-looking itself. Her slight shrugs and way of looking elsewhere while speaking were not unlike Remy Murat's.
When we hear you are the journalist for shiny perfumed magazines of fad and trend, we are told to be unfriendly. But me, I think I am friendly.
Her smile was rictal and showed confused teeth.
My family's loved ones are also large of size.
It is difficult to be large. Steepley's pre-assignment decision was to let all size references pass, as if there was some ability to screen out any reference to size or girth, originating possibly in adolescence.
Your Mr. Delint certainly held himself aloof.
Delint, when we prorectors are suggested to do a thing, he asks to himself only, how can I perfectly do this thing, so the superiors will smile with pleasure at Delint?
Poutrincourt's right forearm is almost twice the size of her left. She wore white sneakers and a Donnie warm-up of a deep, glowing neutron blue that clashed hideously with both their caps. The circles beneath her eyes were also blue.
Why the instructions to be unfriendly?
Poutrincourt always nodded for a while before she replied to anything, as if things had to go through various translation circuits. She nodded and scratched at her long jaw, thinking.
You are here to make publicity a child player, one of our étoiles.
273.
And Dr. Tavis, he is, how you say, quantified.
Quarantined? Suspicious? Guarded?
No.
Confused? Torn? In a quandary?
Quandary is how. Because this is a good place, and highly good. Better since before the present. Perhaps now he is étoile.
A shrug. Long arms akimbo. Hal reemerged from ComEd and, ankle brace or no, displayed a slow, loose, thoroughbred trot past the pavilion and bleachers and to the gate in number 12's southern fence, acting as if unwatched by people in bleachers, and tapped two of his big-headed tennis rackets together to listen for the string's pitch, exchanging some neutral words with Delint, who was standing with Stice at the edge of the transom's shadow. Stice breaking into a half-laugh at something, twirling his racket, and walking back to serve as Hal retrieved a ball along the north fence. Both players' rackets had large heads and thick frames. Terry Poutrincourt said,
And by nature, who does not wish the shiny attention?
That the magazines with Cologne on their pages say this is étoile? Enfield Tennis Academy, it is good?
I'm here to do a soft, inoffensive profile on his brother, with Hal mentioned only as part of an American family, exceptional in several respects. I don't see what's quandariacal for Dr. Tavis about this.
The tiny, plump, officious man who seemed to have a phone tucked under his chin at all times. The kind of frenzied over-cooperation that's a technical interviewer's worst nightmare for an interrogation. The little man's monologue had done to Steepley's brain kind of what a flashbulb does to your eyes, and if he'd explicitly denied him access to the brother, then the denial had been slipped in after he'd worn Steepley down. There was the slight, shaken-saw wobble of bleachers as Delint walked back up, stacked charts against his chest like a schoolgirl's books, his smile at the Quebecois player in his seat as if he'd never met her before, settling in heavily on Steeply's other side. Glancing down at where the profiler had bracketed notes on the possible sounds a string-hit ball sounds like in cold air. Cut, king, ping, pons, puck, cup, thwa, thwat. The Samizdat Entertainment's director's other son chipped a return that caught the tape and sat there a moment and fell back.
Veux-tu que nous parlions en français? Serait plus facile ça?
This invitation because Poutrincourt's eyes had gone hooded the minute the Delint person joined them. Poutrincourt's shrug was blasé. Francophones are never impressed that anyone else can speak French.
Very well, then, look, she said.
Poutrincourt did in Quebecois.
Pubescent stars are nothing new to this sport. Lenglen, Roswell. In AD 1887, a 15-year-old girl won Wimbledon. She was the first. Everett in the semifinals of the U.S. Open at 16, 71 or 2. Austin, Jaeger, Graf, Sawamatsu, Venus Williams, Borg, Villander, Chang, Treffert, Medvedev, Escogna, Becker of the AD 80s. Now this new Argentinian, Kleckner.
Steeply lit a flounder fume that made Delint's face spread with distaste.
You compare it as like gymnastics, figure skating, competitive to swim.
Poutrincourt made no comment on Steeply's syntax.
Just so then. Good.
Steeply was adjusting the long peasant skirt and crossing legs so he was inclined away from Delint, gazing at a kind of translucent mole on Poutrincourt's long cheek. Poutrincourt's thick rimless specs were like a scary nun's. She looked more male than anything, long and hard and breastless. Steeply tried to exhale away from everyone.
The world plateau tennis not being required to have neither the size and muscle of the hockey nor the basketball, nor the American football, for example.
Poutrincourt nodded.
But yes, nor the millimetric precision of your best ball's hitting, nor how the Italians say the sensorori, the never-miss consistency that keeps their golfers from true mastery until they have 30 or more years.
The prorector switched for just a moment to English, possibly for Delint's benefit.
Your French is Parisian, but passable. Me, mine is Quebecois.
Steeply now got to give that same sour Gallic shrug.
You're saying to me serious tennis doesn't need of an athlete anything already adolescents do not possess, if they are exceptional for it.
The medicinists of sports science know well what top tennis requires,
Poutrincourt said, back in French.
Too well, which are the agility, the reflexes.
274.
The short-range speed, the balance, some coordination between the hand and the eye, and very much endurance. Some strength, with particular importance for the male. But all these are achievable by the period of puberty for some. But yes. But wait, she said, putting a hand on the notebook as Steeply started to pretend to inscribe. The thing you have put as the question to me, this is why the quandary. The young players, they have the advantage in psyche, also.
The edge of mentality, Steeply said, trying to ignore the boy speaking into his hand several seats over.
Delint seemed to be ignoring everything around him, engrossed in the match and his statistics. The Canadian prorector's hands moved in small circles out front to indicate engagement in the conversation. Americans' conversational hands sit like lumps of dough most of the time, Rémy Marat had pointed out once.
But yes, so the formidable mental edge that our psyches are still not yet adult in all ways. Therefore, so, they do not feel the anxiety and pressure in the way it is felt by adult players. This is every story of the teenager appearing from no location to upset the famous adult in professional play. The ephebic. They do not feel the pressure. They can play with abandon. They are without fear.
A cold smile. Sunlight blazed on her lenses.
At the beginning they are without pressure or fear. And they burst from seemingly no location onto the professional stage. Instant étoile. Phenomenal. Phyllis. Immunized to pressure. numb to anxiety. At first. They seem as if they are like the adult players, only better. Better in emotion, more abandoned, not human to the stress or fatigue of their airplaning without end, to the publicity.
The English expression of the child in the store of candy.
Seemingly unfeeling of the loneliness and alienation, and everyone wants a thing from the étoile.
The money also.
But it is soon you start to see the burning out which the place like ours is hoping to prevent. You remember Jaeger? Burned out at 16. Austin at 20. Arias and Kriegstein. Esconia and Treffet. Too injured to play on by their late teenage years. The much-promising Capriati. The well-known tragedy. Pat Cash of Australia. Fourth on Earth at 18. Vanished by the 20s of age.
Not to be mentioning the large money. The endorsings and appearings.
Always so for the young étoile. And now worse than today, that the sponsors have no broadcasting to advertise with. Now the Ifib, who is famous étoile, who is in magazines, on the sports reports au disque, he is pursued to become the billboard who walks. Use this, wire this, for money. Millions thrown at you before you can drive the cars you buy. The head swells to the size of a balloon. Why not?
But can pressure be far behind the back? Steeply said.
Many times the same. Winning 2 and 3 upset matches, feeling suddenly so loved, so many talking to you as if there is love. But always the same then. For then you awaken to the fact that you are loved for winning only. The 2 and 3 wins created you for people. It is not that the wins made them recognize something that existed unrecognized before these upset wins. The from no place winning created you. You must keep winning to keep the existence of love and endorsements and the shiny magazines wanting your profile.
Enter the pressure, Steeply said.
Pressure such as one could not imagine. Now that to maintain you must win. Now that winning is the expected, and all alone, in the hotels, on the airplanes, with any other player you could speak to of the pressure to exist wanting to beat you, wanting to be exist above and not below. All the others, wanting from you, and only so long as you play with abandon, winning.
Hence the suicides, the burnout, the drugs, the self-indulging, the spoilage.
What is the instruction if we shape the Ephib into the athlete who can win fearlessly to be loved, yet we do not prepare her for the time after fear comes? No?
Therefore the terrible pressure here. They are being tempered, oven toughened.
Hal served wide and this time followed it in, the serve, taking a stutter step at the service line. Stice's body seemed to elongate as he reached and got the stick up over the return, driving a forehand. Hal volleyed it too short and took a couple steps off the net as Stice came in, winding up for an easy pass. Hal guessed a direction and started to his left, and the darkness chipped a lob right over him and hit the heel of his hand against his strings as Hal gave it up halfway back, Stice not rubbing it in but exhorting himself. Hal's sweat was way heavier than the Kansans, but Stice's face was almost maroon with flush. Each player twirled his stick in his hand as Hal walked back to retrieve the ball. Stice took his position in the deuce court, pulling up his socks. Still smart for Hal to follow the serve in once a game or so, Dillant said into Steeply's ear. And irritating throughout was the heavy-browed, red-nostriled kid James Trulch, at the very end of the top bleacher, speaking into his fist, coming at the fist from first one angle and then another, pretending to be two people.
In Cadenza the controller. In Cadenza the tactician. Rare tactical lapse for In Cadenza, following the serve in when he's just finally started establishing control from the baseline. Have a look at In Cadenza standing there waiting for Ortho Stice to finish futzing with his sock so he can serve.
the resemblance to statues of Augustus of Rome. The regal bearing, the set of the head, the face impassive and emanating command, the chilly blue eyes. The chilly reptilian film of concentration in the cold blue eyes, Jim. The Halster's been having some trouble controlling his volleys. Personally, Jim, I think he'd be better off with his old mid-sized graphite stick than that large head the creepy Dunlop guy got him to switch to. Stice, being the younger player out there, he's grown up with the extra-large head. A large head is all the darkness knows. You could say Stice was born with a large head, and that Incandenza's a man who's adapted his game to a large head. Hal's career dating back to before your polycarbonate resins changed the whole power matrix of the junior game, too, Jim. And what a day for tennis. What a day for family fun of all kinds. This bud's for the whole family. It's the Bud Match of the Week, brought to you. Incandenza even reported to have modified his grip, all to accommodate the large head. And by the multiphasics family of fine graphite-reinforced polycarbonate resins, Ray. Jim, ortho Stice, impossible to even visualize Stice without his trusty large head. It's all they know, these kids. DeLint hiked back onto an elbow on the tier above and told James Trolch to regulate the volume, or he was going to take a personal interest in seeing Trolch suffer. Hal bounced the ball 3 times, tossed, rocked farther back on the toss, and absolutely crunched the serve, spineless and wickedly angled out wide, Stice grotesquely off balance, lunging too far and hitting the backhand cramped, down the line and shallow. Hal moved in to the service line for it, hunched and with his stick cocked up behind him, looking somehow insectile. Stice stood in the middle of the baseline, awaiting pace, and was helpless when Hal shortened the stroke and dribbled it at an angle cross-court, barely clearing the net and distorted with backspin and falling into the half-meter of fair space the acuteness of the angle allowed.
Helene Condenza has the greater tennis brain, Poutrincourt said in English.
Hal aced Stice down the center to go up either 2-1 or 3-2 in the third. The thing you want to know about Hal, babe, is he's got a complete game, DeLint said, as the boys changed ends of the court, Stice holding 2 balls out before him on the face of his racket. Hal went to the towel again. The children along the bottom tier were leaning left and then right in tandem, amusing themselves. The apparition with the lens and metal pole was gone overhead. What do you want to know, watching juniors at this level? DeLint says, still back on an elbow, so his upper body was out of sight, and he was just legs and a voice in Steeply's cold ear. They all have different strengths, areas of the game they're better at, and you can drown in profiling a match or a player in terms of the different strengths and the number of individual strengths.
I am not here to profile the boy, Steeply said, but in French again.
DeLint ignored him. It's not just the strengths or the number of strengths. It's, do they come together to make a game? How complete is a kid? Has he got a game? Those kids at lunch you gotta meet.
But not speak to.
The kid in the idiotic hat, Pemulus. Mike's got great, great volleys. He's a natural at net. Great, great hand-eye. Mike's other strength is he's got the best lob in East Coast Juniors bar none. These are his strengths. The reason both of these kids you're looking at out here right now can beat the living shit out of Pemulus is Pemulus' strengths don't give him a complete game. Volleys are an offensive shot. A lob's a baseliner's weapon, counterpuncher. You can't lob from the net or volley from the baseline.
He says Michael Pemulus' abilities cancel each other out.
275.
Poutrincourt said in the other ear. DeLint made the small salam of iteration.
Pemulus' strengths cancel each other out.
Now, Todd Postlethwaite, the littler kid with the bandage on his nose from the soap and shower slipping thing, Postlethwaite's also got a great lob. And while Pemulus would take him right now on pure age and power, Postlethwaite's the technically superior player with a better future because Todd's built a complete game out of his lob.
This DeLint is wrong,
Poutrincourt said in Quebecois, smiling rictally across Steeply at DeLint.
Because Postlethwaite won't come in to net, Postal threat hangs back at any cost, and unlike Pemulis, he works to develop the groundstrokes to let him stay back and draw the other guy in and use that venomous lob. Which means at 14, his game, it will never change or grow. And if he grows strong and we